This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning.
My mom says my neighborhood school isn't good enough.
How am I supposed to know my kids are getting the best education possible?
Welcome to Good Schools for All, a podcast from the investigative news organization Voice of San Diego.
We cut through the jargon and polarized debate to get you the news and ideas that matter. Good schools are at the heart of our democracy and economy, and we're about good schools for all kids.
We hope you'll learn and maybe teach us something. Enjoy the show.
There should be an excellent school in every community.
I'm Scott Lewis.
I'm Laura Cohn.
Laura.
Hey, Scott.
So we're approaching that time of the year where we just stop educating kids for a while, let them roam free.
Hopefully not. Summer counts too. Or on the other hand, maybe some free roaming would be good for children.
Yeah, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know though. It's one of those problems you don't picture as you're raising your toddlers and such, that you have to plan out their summers. When they get to that point, you got to figure out where they're going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Your job doesn't stop.
Scott, do you help out with that, or is that invisible labor that your wife is covering?
Emotional labor.
Emotional labor, yeah.
I am available, and I have helped, and I stand ready to.
Mm-hmm.
She does this big sheet. She draws it all out and has the calendar that she does a special thing. And she does handle that, but I think she prefers to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. I think I'm on okay.
All right, okay.
I think I'm okay. I'm dividing this okay.
Okay, all right. I'll let that be.
But I
did cover it for our family too, and it's a lot. It is a lot of
logistics.
There's a lot of logistics,
yeah.
Yeah, because when the summertime programs are only part day, then you're not just doing one. As a working parent, you need coverage not just for that program, but then you have to figure out what's going on the rest of the day too.
You thought you got me, didn't you? You thought you just nailed me on emotional labor.
I don't know if I did or not until Ashley weighs in.
Well, I think I'm okay. I think I'm on. Look, early in our marriage, the emotional labor balance really out of whack. But I have learned. I'm a lot more woke, but I got more work
to
do. I'm
good,
sure.
Good.
I recognize at least.
That's a start. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we're going to do something a little bit new for this show. We've got coming up the newish superintendent of the San Diego County Office of Education coming in to talk. And if you don't know what the San Diego County Office of Education is, well, we got your show for you.
Yes, we do.
But we're going to go through a couple of our latest bits of news and talk about them for a second. Then we'll get into the show or the interview and what's working as well. We got a What's Working in Number of the Week this week. Okay, first, let's get into some stories. So NBC 7 San Diego first reported last week that San Diego County's largest public school system, the San Diego Unified School District, has revived plans to delete all of its emails older than 1 year and will pull the trigger on that on June 1st. So that there was like an alarm bell going off in our office about this. Like, you know, they cite like costs. There's no cost to storing emails. It's imperative to be able to request some of these documents and such. So the district had initially planned to make that purge last July without seeking board approval or even public input. And then there was an outcry, and we were part of that outcry. But even some unions were, and they expressed concern about the rush without training employees how to retain older archived emails and such. So that's something to watch. Obviously, a lot of oversight. But also, what would you do without email that you had to get rid of after a year?
I thought when I read that. I rely a lot on searching for old emails and finding out threads. So yeah, that was one thing I thought of, aside from the ducking accountability motive that seems to be behind it.
I don't get it. But okay, also in San Diego Unified, a district committee that was set up a task force to study how the Board of Education at San Diego Unified is elected. So right now there are no term limits for trustees at the school district. And if you run for a Board of Education seat, you have to run in your sub-district, which is your group of neighborhoods. And if you are one of the top two finishers in that contest, you have to run across the whole district in the runoff. That's a big lift.
It is. It's expensive to communicate with the whole city, for one thing.
Yeah, it's not quite the whole city of San Diego, but it's almost. Right. And it's a big, big area, a lot of people. I mean, we're talking a campaign of several hundred thousand dollars, if not $1 million, to be able to reach people at mm-hmm. that level. And there's very few interests that want to put that much money into it.
Right.
And so it makes it the one, of course, most prominent interest that is able to do that in many cases is the teachers union. And so there's a lot of discussion about, well, does that need to shift? There's a lot of other school districts and other cities across the region that have been forced into district elections because it's often seen as more representative of those areas, and those areas don't have their vote washed out by other people in other parts of the city. And so there was a grand jury recommendation last year to switch to district or these sub-district elections and to put term limits on. And so there was a discussion at the San Diego City Council to put that on the ballot, because the San Diego City Council is the only one that can put charter changes on the ballot. And the charter of the city of San Diego is actually the governing document, the sort of founding document of the city school system.
Right. Unique in the region. That's only true for San Diego City Schools.
So they had those, that was floated as two options to put on the ballot. That was thrown out. But the district, sort of seeing that this was something that would not necessarily die, put together this group. That group has studied. Now, the group recommended that the term limits be put on the ballot, so three terms. As a limit, but they did not recommend that sub-district election change be put on the ballot. They didn't not recommend it. They just didn't say it should be. And so the school district can say, I think we'll say, like, we want this on the ballot, and sort of send that to the city council, and the city council could then do what it wants with that.
Does it have to go to the ballot in order to make the change, or could the city council decide on its own?
No, it would have to go to the ballot. It's a charter change, and can only be changed by the vote of the people. And there's only two ways mm-hmm. to get a vote of the people on. The city council can itself put something on, or that somebody could run a citizens initiative. So the last time this was tried was when those guys put together the San Diegans for Great Schools proposal that would have expanded the school district's number of trustees and allowed for some of them to be appointed. Yeah. So there was also some discussion about potentially increasing the number of trustees. And so all those things are going to go to the school board now. The school board doesn't have to accept the committee's recommendation, and the city council previously, of course, shot it down. So number three, this week we did a piece about the Sweetwater Union High School District and how it had investigated a male teacher last year for sexual misconduct. After the investigation concluded, district officials signed a resignation agreement in October 2017 that allows the teacher to remain on paid leave through June 30th. It requires he seek full-time employment elsewhere. The deal contemplates he'll be reemployed at another public school, and if the teacher is hired only part-time, Sweetwater agreed to pay the difference to preserve his existing income and the level of benefits that he gets right now. And as part of the deal, Sweetwater agreed to drop all existing investigations and to tell people the teacher is employed in a special assignment position this year and not talk about the accusations. So we didn't do just that story, but we wanted to use that story as also just an explanation of just how these systems work. We've done a lot of these stories now across the county of these teachers. We are allowed to get access to the documents if A, the accusations were substantiated, and B, they are substantial accusations. And so those are very subjective decisions, mm-hmm. and these individual school districts have interpreted our requests and their own responsibility to deliver on them differently. And so we just had a positive ruling from the judge, Judge Fraser, who's reviewing some of these cases in North County for us. And so he says they have to come out, and so there might be more reporting on that. But basically, look, settlements that forbid victims from speaking out, poor record keeping, inconsistent policies, union protections, costly litigation, and just not believing kids are all factors that help public school employees accused of sexual harassment, misconduct, evade accountability. And so we're learning more about that whole system right now.
Not just evade accountability, or maybe that's a euphemism for continuing to teach children and have right. access to children. And you're saying all of these cases met the threshold of substantial and substantiated, and many of a lot of what you're documenting is that they were still in classrooms with children after young people and children after that. So it's troubling.
Yeah. So we're finding little things too, like, well, if you accuse somebody of doing something, it's very difficult for you to find out that he or she may have had several other accusations because there's just, it's the way it's all managed. You know, it's not built to very quickly react to these situations or to believe the student. So as we go through this whole Me Too reckoning across the country, the school systems are going to have their own. And this is, it's just been an incredible quest to watch all of these different cases and to get the feedback that we've been getting after each story. It's just like literally Me Too, Me Too, Me Too. It's just, it's overwhelming. So we'll have more on that. It's a fascinating investigation. Okay, and finally, and this relates to our interview today, there are several ballot decisions that you need to make if you care about everything in local public affairs, including schools. There are a lot of people, I think, who don't really recognize the value or importance of primary elections, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they think, well, I'll pay attention when it's November.
Right.
That's fine, except that there are decisions that will be final in June. And a couple of those are mostly at the county level. The county, for example, county supervisors, if a supervisor candidate gets more than 50% of the vote, they win outright.
Yep.
That's probably unlikely for the for at least the County District 4 election. The supervisors, Nathan Fletcher, Omar Passons, Bonnie Dumanis, Lori Saldana, Ken Marlborough, they're all running in that race. That'll probably not hit 50%. The other one in District 5, the North one, that might. Jim Desmond, Jerry Kern running in that race maybe could come close to 50%. But the two, the district attorney, that'll definitely get 50%. There's only two candidates, so one of them will win outright.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So Summer Stephan,
I hadn't thought of that.
Is the interim DA. She's running against Genevieve Jones-Wright, and that'll get decided. So if you have a preference of two very different people for district attorney.
Oh. So this is it. This is your opportunity to weigh in on the DA race.
Exactly.
This upcoming primary, okay?
And then sheriff. Dave Myers, a commander in the sheriff's department, is running against his boss, the incumbent, Bill Gore.
Mm-hmm.
That'll also be decided in June. There's no other candidates. So there's no way one of them won't get 50%. And then assessor, Matt Strabone, running against Ernest Dronenberg. And again, the winner of 50% or more becomes the assessor for good or for the next 4 years. There's another race, and this relates to our particular interest today at Good Schools for All, and that is the race for County Board of Education. So there was a lot of interest in these races in last time around, 2016. There was kind of a battle between unions and charter school advocates. The American Federation of Teachers dumped a ton of money in, as did the Charter Schools Association. Basically, the issue at hand is that the County Board of Education serves as the appellate sort of court or board.
Mm-hmm.
If your charter school is rejected by a local school district, you can appeal to the county.
Right.
And charter school advocates were saying that the county was just not approving enough of these appeals, was not considering them close enough. So that battle looks like it might come out again. So the Cheryl James Ward is running for the seat that's currently held by Rick Shea. Shea is a former special assistant to the county superintendent. And he was a juvenile court teacher as well. And Cheryl James Ward, she works at E3 Civic High, the charter school downtown.
Mm-hmm.
She's the academic innovation director there. And she's the wife of the former district superintendent, Randy.
Look at that, full circle.
Lots going on there.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be a big race. And she, the charter schools don't say yet that they support her, but Shea has long had the support of the teachers union. So that'll be an interesting race. And again, if somebody gets more than 50% of the vote.
And with two candidates, somebody will get more than 50% of the vote.
Right. That's that.
Okay. Get out and vote, people.
Get out and vote, people. Okay. So along those lines.
Or fill out those ballots that have already arrived in the mail.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a lot there. So if you care about any of these issues, again, the primary matters. All right. Our number of the week.
Our number of the week is 15%. 15% is the proportion of San Diego County public school students who are enrolled in charters. Mm. And I was curious about it from all, you know, all of our conversation about charters and our and my perception that charter growth had stalled in the county. That was just my perception. So I just looked it up and found out that's not the case. It turns out that just in the 14-15 school year, it was 12%.
Wow.
So it's grown from 12% to 15% in just the last 4 years.
Like a tick a year almost.
A tick a year, exactly. That was the trajectory. So charters, you know, I guess once I read that, I realized, well, yeah, we've seen Thrive schools opening up and High Tech High maybe has opened a campus in that time and some other new ones have come on. So yeah, the growth is continuing.
Hmm. All right. And what's working?
Well, for what's working, I want to just cite our guest that we're about to talk to, Paul Gotthold. There was a real lack of trust between the County Office of Education and the 42 school districts. Maybe not all 42 of them, but many of them had gotten to a place where they really didn't have a lot of faith that the County Office of Education was acting in their interest. And Paul Gotthold arrived a little less than a year ago and has really already regained trust of a lot of the superintendents and school board leaders around the county. So I think that's a really positive change for education in this county.
All right. If you are interested in getting to know him, that's what we did.
Voice of San Diego podcasts are sponsored in part by a proud supporter of Monarch School and Make-A-Wish San Diego. As a nonprofit news organization, we depend on our members, foundations, and sponsors to provide funding to support the investigative journalism you expect from us. We are very grateful for all of our supporters, and we will recognize them during the show. Make-A-Wish San Diego grants wishes to children with critical illnesses in San Diego and Imperial counties. Visit sandiego.wish.org to find out how you can help make wishes come true. And Monarch School has served San Diego for nearly 3 decades, beginning as a one-room education center and expanding into a K-12 comprehensive school designed to educate homeless youth. To find out more or to get involved, visit monarchschools.org. If you like Voice of San Diego's work and want to become a sponsor too, contact us at development@voiceofsandiego.org.
Okay, we are joined in the Great Voice San Diego podcast studio by Paul Gotthold. He's the superintendent of the San Diego County Office of Education, newish of sorts. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So thank you for coming. So we should probably just establish, first of all, what the County Office of Education is. We've probably explained this a dozen times, maybe, but it's still confusing to a lot of people. So basically, it's kind of an umbrella agency in some cases, representing the state of California in San Diego. Is that fair?
That's fair. It serves two primary purposes. One is we provide educational services, programs, and schools to our most vulnerable youth. So our kids in the camps and the halls, expelled probation, foster homeless. And our other responsibility is to support the 42 districts of San Diego County. So we act as an intermediary between the state. We do have a financial compliance that we have to monitor and approve district budgets. And now with the new accountability system, there's an educational component as well, which is to provide technical assistance for those who need support in that area as well.
Okay. And distinguish the role of the office with its board. So there's a 5-member school board, right?
That is
and
correct.
And they're the ones that hire you, of course. But there is a distinguishing role, right? It's not necessarily just to oversee the Office of Education's work.
Correct. So the Board of Education is elected. The mm-hmm. county is divided into 5 trustee areas, and they serve as an appeals board for charters, expulsion, interdisciplinary transfers from the districts, but also to install the superintendent.
Got it. So basically, you manage a bunch of schools. You oversee some of the district's finances, provide services to other, some of the many districts in San Diego. And then your office, along with the board, handles various appeals for charter schools, for people who get expelled from school. So if a charter school applies for a charter at its local school district, it doesn't get approved, they can appeal to you. And your office handles that until it gets to the board. Is that fair?
That is correct.
Okay, good. And tell us about you. Where do you come to San Diego from?
I come from the Los Angeles area. I was born and raised in Southeast LA. And I have been in public education for about 24 years now. Mm-hmm. So I began my career as a teacher in Los Angeles County Office of Education and had the distinct pleasure of working with probation, expelled, vulnerable youth, and actually come from a family of educators. My mom raised four of us on her own. She was a traveling music teacher, casualty of Prop 13, and raised four children on her own. I swore I would never be an educator. Watching her struggle, and I fell into it indirectly. I fell in love with it by virtue of the fact of working with kids and just providing hope. Watching them change before your eyes and now doing great things in life. We were successful not only getting kids through high school, but into college and off the streets and out of gangs and out of the system. And many of them are productive members of our society. And so I saw the power of public education, being able to transform lives and provide hope.
You mentioned that you have as the County Office of Education, have a new responsibility with equity issues because of some changes. I think you're referring to the local control formula of funding and your responsibilities overseeing that. Is that true?
Yeah. So really the state has kind of shifted the balance of funding for California to provide more money for our most vulnerable youth. So foster, homeless, English language students, it's in the form of supplemental and concentration grants. And so districts have this additional money to really provide product services and support for our neediest kids.
How do you think that new system's going for districts, for children, for families?
Well, I think from my perspective, and I'll answer this as coming from a comprehensive district in Linwood, California, which was 96% free and reduced lunch.
And that's where you were superintendent just before you moved down here to
San
Diego. Yeah,
I worked there for 7 years, and a lot of things in our strategic plan at the time were accelerated because of this new funding model. We were able to remove a lot of barriers for students. Being able to pay for PSAT, SAT. We test every kid, had options and access to these. We hired health techs. We noticed that there were a number of students, about 3,000, that didn't have access to health insurance. We were able to hire an equity director to have conversation around implicit bias and inclusion. And so what LCFF did for a district like ours was really kind of accelerate some things that we want to do for our underserved kids. And so I think in some ways it's been beneficial, but the reality, when you look at the entire picture where we are as a county office and in my role as superintendent for the county, representing and supporting 42 school districts, is really advocating for base funding because it supports all of our programs. California still ranks 46 in pupil spending compared to other states. And so we really have to, pay attention to a lot of our districts who don't have some of those supplemental funds and make sure that we're advocating for them as well.
When we were preparing for this interview, Laura mentioned to me that you don't like the term achievement gap. When we talk about the gap between how well white and Asian students often tend to do on performance measures in schools and how well Latino and Black students often do. And we use that as a way of saying, like, well, these schools need to work harder, need to change something, need to do something to improve not only this performance of all students, but that a specific gap is troubling to a lot of people. And what's your issue with that term?
Well, I think it's a widely used and somewhat accepted term in the industry. The fear I have is that we get caught comparing black and brown kids to white and Asian kids who may not have had similar experiences. I prefer to talk about the educational gaps, the opportunity gaps. In my humble opinion, in my experience, a lot of students don't have access to higher level courses, AP courses. There are a number of prerequisites. We in public education have been ingrained to sort and categorize kids. And what happens is a lot of our students then get left out of having access to core material from a very young age and separated. And so what I have found, at least in my experience, to be helpful, as long as you are addressing not only access for all students to have an experience and a rigorous educational experience, and then fill their gaps on the back end with supplemental resources and support, then we'd be pretty well off. The problem is they don't have opportunities that some other students have had.
Well, yeah, because access to AP courses, while uneven, the opportunity gaps are really present earlier, and it's disadvantaging a lot of students in being able to perform or access those kinds of courses. What are some of the other opportunity gaps that both you see, but that you think you can help districts activate on, or that you've seen districts in this community do a good job of starting to fix?
Yeah, I mean, I just alluded to one of those, and that's just tracking. I mean, we track students. So you'll have, for example, some districts who will have English language students, and they're all grouped together, and they never have access to those core courses. Universal preschool is an area where we can close some of those gaps for some of our students who have never been in preschool. Their preschool actually is at home. Some of our students don't have access to academic language, to books. So there are a number of areas. You could point to healthcare. You could point to food. You can point to some of our students in our own system, in our own classrooms, have experienced trauma and other elements that some of us should never have to endure as adults alone and their children, and only understand violence and some of these other things. So I think that there's a number of areas that when you talk about the gaps, that we just have to do the best we can to meet every single need of the student. And one thing that we do and strive to do in our programs is to provide hope, to build relationships with our children. You know, in some of our programs, they start the day just talking about what's going on in their life. And sometimes that's good enough because you have an adult in the room that cares. You have students and their peers who understand what they're going through, and it sets the tone and gives them the ability to actually get engaged in academic lessons and things of that nature. So we just do whatever it takes to help the kids. And I think that we have made a lot of progress, particularly around social emotional learning and some of these other elements, but we have a long way to go too.
I want to go back to something you said, where you said that the sorting of children that happens sometimes early itself has an effect on what resources they have available. Can you expand on that a little bit? What do you
sure.
mean?
Sure. So I have direct experience in multiple districts experiencing this notion of putting kids in different classrooms, even at the elementary level. Some are in one track where they have access to regular grade level appropriate material, and others do not. They're actually in different courses. They do not have access to that grade level appropriateness. So I'll give you an example. In my previous district, what we did was just make sure that we aligned our curriculum, the expectations, the target that we wanted for all students, regardless if it was a first grader, a sixth grader, an eighth grader, was the same at all of our schools. Not rigid enough to where it's prescriptive, but just that those were the intended outcomes, and they were very simple. And so we still gave schools
so
a tremendous...
So that implies that before you started that work, that you saw some unevenness across your schools? You know, how does that look as a superintendent? You're looking across your schools. How do you see that those inequalities?
It's the expectations for children. There was adult perceptions that some kids could not do the work of grade level appropriate material, and so they were put in a different track, mm-hmm. plain and simple. And what we strove to do was make sure that students had access, regardless of adults' perception of what kids could or could not do, access to that material, and then 50% of the time, make sure that they were doing things that were specific to what their needs were and levels. So there was an element of independent learning, an element of exploration, an element of small group work, where students were really tuned into their own Lexile levels, where they were, so they could progress. But there was also 50% of the time where they had access to that rigorous coursework. So, you know, in short, the district had, you know, 58% graduation rate. 7 years later, they're now at 93% at both high schools. You know, that I don't think that happens by mistake. It was a system of practice that really was the result of a community getting together and saying, what do we want students to look like when they leave our program? And so when we talk about opportunity gaps, it's they can be subtle also. You have some of them, if you look at inclusion, you look at the makeup of some of these high-level courses or IB, and what is the representation? Does it fit with the general population of the school or not? And it's not necessarily because those options are limited to those students, is do they feel comfortable and welcome there as well?
So to get there, you have to change some teachers' beliefs about children, the children that they're teaching. In your experience, you know, are there some teachers who just can't get over that hump, who can't shift their perspective? Or, you know, how do you work through that in terms of the personnel that you have in your schools, the teachers on the front line?
Well, again, what we have to do is make sure, first of all, we have a plan. Do we believe all kids can learn? I don't think anyone wakes up in the morning and says, you know, I'm going to go to work and hurt children. I think everyone's intentions are good. I think everyone that's in public education, for the most part, wants to do good things and wants to see their students successful. I think change is very hard for adults. It's not conducive to the human condition. We get comfortable and complacent. And I think that it's incumbent upon us as leaders to show individuals what this could look like. And I think it's incumbent upon us also to engage them in the conversation about what the solution is. This was not entirely a top-down approach. We had a strategic plan. It involved our bargaining units. It involved teachers and kids and parents. We said, what do we want our kids to look like? And then when we started having those conversations, we started with the data. And we put these in front of our work groups, in front of teams of teachers, and said, help me with this. Our kids are not successful. What are some of those barriers? We looked at all of the choke points in our organization. We wanted to, number one, take away all the excuses, but also go back to research that we knew were going to support the adults in their learning curve. And that was the brain research. That was a lot of different elements where we know any kid can learn anything under the right circumstances and the support, unless they have a physical impairment. And when you start to shift the conversation and show examples of where it's working in different places, I think people become respected. But the number one thing that we did was really bringing the provider into the district. We invested in human and social capital. We trained extensively and invested at least 5 to 10 days of professional development for every teacher in our system. And they came together in course-like teams or grade level appropriate. And really, it was a joint effort between a lot of people. And we had the principals sit side by side with them, because if they don't know what they're doing inside and out, there's no way for them to monitor and support it.
This is a topic we obviously obsess on. I mean, the show is called Good Schools for All. The question of inequities within a particular neighborhood, within a particular district, sometimes are kind of overwhelming. And I wonder if you go to a party or something, and sometimes I'll be at a party or something, and somebody will say, like, well, why are schools so different? I don't understand. Like, or, you know, obviously it's because, well, La Jolla and Bird Rock is wealthy, and then you go to, you know, Porter Elementary, that's not a wealthy area. It's a different thing. When you explain the differences between what resources are available for some students and what resources are available for others, what is the primary driver of inequity in resources in our schools?
I don't know if I'm entirely equipped to answer that. What I can tell you is that there are a number of schools that have foundations that are quite robust, that are supported by the families and businesses of those schools. I couldn't give you a side-by-side comparison. I think the original intent of LCFF was to try and mitigate some of those inequities of resources. And really, that's what we want to do is support those schools that aren't having the same desired outcome for students, and making sure that we provide every single resource, program, and support necessary through this additional or this different funding model. But also to learn from each other. I do want to make clear one thing, being new to San Diego and in my 10th or 11th month or whatever that is, there are some incredible school districts here. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the best that I've seen. I've been around the country and have had the pleasure and privilege of looking at some really strong school systems in other states, and San Diego has a pretty special system in place with our schools and districts. And I think that because of the size or because of the commitment, the way that I see the Board of Supervisors, the California Workforce Partnership, all of these different agencies have such a vested interest in helping, that, you know, we coming together to really take a look at some of these areas that we can better support, I think is going to we're going to see some impact on our kids. Hmm.
One of the things we studied a lot last year and went through was this question of what we're trying to actually achieve. And we did a lot of work understanding some graduation rates. There was a graduation rate at San Diego Unified School District that was very good. And we wanted to understand like what they had done to get there. And pulling on it, realized that a lot of kids in the middle of high school had gone to alternative programs or whatnot that didn't factor into that number necessarily. And that, to me, brings up the question of, like, what is graduation? What does graduation mean? If you know, you can do a bunch of different things to get there, to get the degree, to get the, not the degree, diploma, and you know, some credit recovery courses, technology-based, charter schools, all these things were presented as options. What is it to you that, what does it mean to you to get a high school diploma, and what should that mean to the workforce and to the student?
Yeah, great question. You know, I've also always, 25 years that I've been doing this, have encouraged every kid that I've had the opportunity to work with to strive past a high school graduation diploma. You know, everything that we do now requires some sort of post-secondary education. A high school graduation is just not enough. And I think I saw a statistic in the last Opportunity Gap Summit that by 2020, 60% of the jobs are going to require a bachelor's degree. We need an educated workforce. We need the only thing that I would say when kids are exploring alternative means and different programs, I have no problem as long as the rigor is there and the expectation, the skills that kids are coming out of that are going to match preparation for college and the workforce. And you'll see through our office this next year, really emphasizing that connection to real-world experiences and making sure that kids know what careers are available to them and the skills that are necessary to succeed in the workforce for tomorrow. So a graduation diploma is simply, you know, I think that's shooting too low. You know, in my previous district, we often talked about the moral imperative to prepare every student to go to college. And if the kid didn't go to college, it was going to be the kid's choice, but not the system. Mm-hmm. So there was a college prep track, and every kid was on it. And then I don't even know if all of them knew it. Mm. But there was not one course that was offered that wasn't A through G approved. Mm. They took 4 years of math. And if you didn't succeed in Algebra 2, you had to take statistics. We just wanted the best and to prepare our kids for the best. Now, if the child chooses not to go to college, that's fine. Are we really hurting a kid if they can write research papers and compute at a higher level? For many of our students, they may decide to go to college when they're 20, 21, and at least they have that foundation. Did we do it perfectly? Absolutely not. But I think that when you look at the United States and where we're going with innovation, with new business, we are at full economy. That new, in San Diego in particular, this is like a Silicon Valley. There's a number of startups, some 460 biotech firms. We have to make sure our kids are connected to that. We have to make sure that they understand what jobs are available to them now, but in the next 5-10 years.
So, Paul, what's the County Office of Ed's role, if any, in helping to make sure that all of the school districts, all of the high schools in this county have that same approach, that same attitude, and those same systems in place to get every kid not just to graduation, but beyond. And I say that in the context of recognizing that the federal government has really let go of most of its accountability, responsibilities, and the state is still figuring out what its role is in accountability after basically stopping its accountability role for a few years. Does some of that now, well, I know a lot of it lands with us locally. We have to be more attentive to our schools. And so the role of journalism like Voice of San Diego is more important in education than it was previously. What do you think of as the County Office of Ed's role?
Well, first and foremost, there's some outstanding examples of this work in pockets all across our county in multiple school districts. I think it's incumbent upon us to understand what those are. We've just recently hired a chief innovation officer and an executive director for research and innovation, and really take a look at our career tech ed program and build that out so that we understand where those places in our districts that have these outstanding programs and how we scale that work to other parts in the county. We are a convener. I mean, one of the advantages we have as a county office is we can pull districts together to have those conversations. Just recently, we bussed a number of district officials to visit some schools that did this really well, that had such strong articulation agreements with higher education and the workforce that it gave them, you know, that renewed spirit and energy. And then we can lock them into trainings and support that we have available to us at our office and just continue to build out that work. But for us, we really want every child to experience those learning opportunities throughout the county, regardless of where they are.
One of the things that was a big subject in the 2016 election for the Board of Education in the county was the issue of these appeals of charter schools. And several of the candidates were supported by some of the charter school allies and opposed by some of the unions. And then, and now there's a new candidate, Cheryl Ward, executive at one of the charter schools downtown, E3. She's also the wife of your predecessors, and she's running. And I think this issue is going to come up again. What have you noticed since you came in about how it was distinct here, how things worked here versus in other places that you've worked, but also what's happening now as far as understanding some of these charter applications that are rejected from their district, but come to you and come to your board?
Sure. We're an appeals board, as we talked about earlier. And, you know, for us, we go by our process. We have a process to evaluate every charter that comes through us from the financial aspect, educational aspect. And we have a team that spends quite a bit of time, and they make a recommendation to our board, plain and simple. You know, we consider parent choice and all the other elements that are involved. I will tell you that the Shasta-Anderson ruling has really changed the context of the charter school world, in that now charters who have been operating for 16, 18 years now have to go through their local school districts to get authorized. They can no longer work under the umbrella of where they were previously authorized if their centers were outside of that jurisdiction. So it has caused a little bit of strain across our state, and we take every single charter school on a case-by-case basis. We have a team that goes through that process, and we are ourselves building out a charter office to really have a better understanding of the schools that are coming to us, the relationships with those districts, because we need to facilitate that, not necessarily take a position.
What's your interpretation of the role of charter schools in a functioning education system?
Well, I know the original intent, and many schools exemplify this, was to really challenge comprehensive and traditional districts to do things different and take an innovative approach. I think High Tech High is a pretty good example of that. They've been around for a very long time, and I had the opportunity and pleasure of building a career tech ed school from the ground up that featured five academies, and that was actually one of the schools that we visited. And so it's really to provide options that may not be available in your neighborhood school, and provide options for kids, plain and simple.
So is the county the authorizer for, how many charters does the county currently oversee right now?
I don't know the exact number. It may be three, and three to five, I would be on the safe side to guess.
Do you think under this new ruling that the county will end up being the authorizer for more charters in the future?
I honestly can't presuppose the board's decision or have a gauge on that. Again, we just take these charter petitions on a case-by-case basis. Our staff is working on a couple right now as we speak.
Well, Paul Gothold, appreciate your time, and good luck with this challenge.
Thank you. Pleasure to serve.
Can I ask one more question?
Of course.
Yeah, we can weave it in if it. And so, Paul, I noticed with the incident in, sorry, I'll start over. Is it Parkland or Parkview?
Parkland. Yeah.
Parkland. Okay. Paul, I noticed in the media coverage that followed the Parkland shooting in Florida that, especially in the immediate aftermath, there was a lot of consternation directed at the school. You should have caught this individual. You should have done more to intervene with him and prevent this terrible tragedy from occurring. And the school district and the school, I thought, did a really good job of gathering all the information about what it had done to support Nicholas Cruz and counsel him and give him alternative education arrangements. And yet this, you know, he still made that terrible crime and decision. What do you see here in San Diego, and especially since the County Office of Education is responsible for serving kids with, you know, involved in the criminal justice system and with troubles? What do you see as the systems in place here in California, here in San Diego, that would help to prevent a tragedy like Parkland?
Well, first and foremost, I want to make sure that it's expressed that our schools are still the safest places to be, period, bar none. And what I was extremely proud of is the way that our staff had articulated the support and training that they had provided to districts around all of these issues that you're speaking of. And I think that there was a number of school districts that had these community forums across our county, you know, to really make sure that parents understood what it was that they did have in place. And what I found through feedback from school officials and parents is they were surprised at how much training, how much investment had been going into prevention and intervention on these areas. And so recently we convened our 42 districts once again, just to make sure that those protocols are enforced, that they are in place, and how could we better enhance and support them and increase the communication with law enforcement, our mental health agencies. So we continue to support that 110%, but I'm really proud of all the things that are in place in the schools in this county.
But so when there is an individual who has expressed violent thoughts and ideation, or has brought a knife to school as Nicholas Cruz did, what happens here in San Diego County, and what role does the County Office of Education have in a case like that?
You know, the county office is not privy to every single individual case that happens at every district. I mean, the districts have protocols, whether this is a perceived threat or incident that's done in-house administratively, or it rises to the area of a criminal threat in which law enforcement and other agencies are activated. For us as a county office, where we have an active role is on the training and prevention. But if there's a student or parent who appeals any expulsion hearing that's taken place at the local level, then our board would be involved there.
Dr. Paul Gothard, thanks for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you.